future-proof gold.
With Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
On News Talk.
I'm delighted to welcome our next guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist, science communicator and director of the Hayden Planetarium. He's also co-author of a new book, A Brief Welcome to the Universe, a pocket-sized tour. He joins me now. You're very welcome, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a long time since we spoke. I don't know if anyone remembers, but one of the first interviews I ever had on this program when I just started out as a radio broadcaster, knowing nothing about science, but really enthusiastic about it, I interviewed you, and your eloquence and your way with words, your ability to communicate science was a real, it made me think there's a real future in this.
Plus, all you really need is enthusiasm for most anything to be good at it. And I think that's an undervalued asset. Often people think the prerequisite is you just have to be good at something. But if you're enthusiastic, that will transcend however good you thought you were, even if you didn't like the subject at all. So I think more enthusiastic people in the world is what we need. Yeah.
You can read the enthusiasm in this book. And so one of the things that comes with being a science presenter and having done thousands of radio interviews by this stage is that I know a little bit about astrophysics. And so I knew some of the things in the book, but it's the way you have decided to shape and present that information that makes it so compelling. But there was something I didn't know, and I wanted to pick up on you. And so I'm talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson. Let's talk about some astrophysics. So you said stars will finish using fusing all their thermonuclear fuel, and one by one they'll blink out. And my question is, once the stars burn out, does the waste of that star not get pulled back into something else and start a star anew? Or why is that? Because that matter is still there. Why has it changed so fundamentally that stars cannot rekindle?
Yeah, because stars don't rekindle from stars. Stars kindle or rekindle from gas clouds. And our Milky Way has gas in it. It might be 10, I've checked the last numbers, 10, 20% of its mass in gas. And so it still has some star manufacturing ahead of itself. And whereas right. other kinds of galaxies that have these elliptical shapes, in fact, we call them elliptical galaxies, they have very little gas in them. So all of those stars will just burn out and there won't be any fresh supply to replace them. So when they burn out, it's just a stellar corpse right where it was. I mean, they'll be orbiting the center of the galaxy, but there aren't circumstances in which anything else will happen to that corpse. And so, yeah, there it is. And that image that you found in the book, many people have commented to me on that, like how depressing that is or how sad that is, especially when I gesture with my thumb and index finger and I say the stars just blink out one by one, leaving a night sky void of all light at all. Night is dark, but we rely on the stars as something to guide us through the night, knowing that the sun will then rise. Well, the sun will one day burn out, as well as all the other stars in the night sky. So imagine looking up and seeing nothing at all. That's a sad future for the universe. And, you know, there's no other way to slice it. That's what it is. Oh, by the way, so if you take this stellar corpse and merge stellar corpses, it's just one bigger corpse. It's not going to make a new star. It's like having a bonfire, and then the bonfire is done and you have ash in the middle and you say, oh, let's rekindle this bonfire. You're not, right? Because all the fuel is exhausted. And so that's the fuel is the thermonuclear fusion of light elements to heavy elements. Our sun and most stars in the universe are converting hydrogen into helium in their cores. And when you run out of the hydrogen in your core, you're left with helium. And now the helium then, we use the word burn, but it's really fusion. Helium goes to carbon and nitrogen right on up the periodic table of elements. And you get to these heavy elements and then there's nothing, we're done. And by the way, you can as you know from 20th century physics, the heaviest of elements can be split, and you get energy from that. That's nuclear fission. You can do that. There's some of those very heavy elements in the universe, but not enough to rekindle a whole life cycle of stars.
So that was my question. That when these stars blow up, you've got all this sort of fused material. Surely the weight and gravity of it all makes it very unstable, and something happens. But you're saying no.
Well, so let me just add a little middle detail there, because you're still. You don't want this to happen in the universe. So let me toss you a bone, okay? So I was very careful to say that when the sun exhausts the hydrogen in its core, then it has a core of helium, and then the helium fuses to make carbon. There are stars that will do that all the way up to iron in their core. But how about the rest of the star? The rest of the star still has hydrogen. All right, that wasn't hot enough in the rest of the star for the hydrogen to do anything. So just hung out there, all right? Dead weight, literally, okay? Or living weight. And so when the star blows up, it scatters all of the hydrogen it did not fuse back into the galaxy, right, as well as some of the heavier elements that would not be as fertile in the new formation of a star. So the heavy elements plus all the unburned hydrogen go back into the gas clouds. That's how we got here. That's how our star system has planets at all. Because the universe began with just hydrogen and helium, basically. And we've got carbon and nitrogen and we got all kinds of extra elements. Those are forged in stars, scattered and then exploded, scattered that enrichment into gas clouds that would form subsequent generation stars. We were not born at the beginning of the galaxy. We were born 5 billion years ago, and the galaxy was born 12 billion years ago. So there's a lot of enrichment going on over that time. And so, right. And this will continue with the gas clouds, of which there are many in our galaxy, until there's no gas left. And there you go. Get over it.
Yeah, you were talking about what happens in the core of a star, and I was wondering, how do we know what happens in the core of a star? Is that something we have to model, or is it something we can measure?
So both, actually. There's this very outdated concept that it's not really true unless you can see it, okay? Seeing is believing, or there's the whole understanding that people have of nature where if it doesn't otherwise reach your senses, how could it really be true? And one of the great contributions of science to civilization is the ability to make measurements that have nothing to do with your five senses. Right? I can detect magnetic fields and electromagnetic energy and radiation fields. I can detect things that your body can't, or by the time it does detect it, it's too late. All right. And so we have all these ways to see what's going on, even though your eyes cannot detect it. Okay, so here we have this star. We can measure how much energy it's generating. And we can say, and this is a great, I love your question, because it forces me to tell you, not forces me, it invites me to tell you how we figured this out, right? So we have this big ball of gas in the sky. And people are saying, well, we don't even know it's gas yet. It's just a big ball and it's burning. And we know how much energy it's giving out total. We know how much energy Earth is receiving, and Earth is intersecting a tiny amount of all the energy going in all directions. So you just do some fast geometry on that. You can get a total energy output of the sun. And then you ask, okay, what's the sun made of? Well, you go back 150 years, what's the highest density energy we had or knew about? It was charcoal. It was like charcoal, right? You burn charcoal, that's a high energy density. And so we said, maybe the sun is made of coal, okay? So if the sun is made of coal and it's burning at that rate, how long would a chunk of coal that size last if it's burning at the rate we measure? We got a few million years, maybe 10 million years tops. well, biological evolution required much longer, millions of years. Geologists needed tens of millions and maybe even billions of years. And other needs that we found in astrophysics also put huge pressure on that number. And no one is saying that Earth predated the sun. That's an absurd assumption. The sun is a million times larger than the Earth. The Earth wasn't just dangling in space and something a million times larger showed up and decided to invite us to orbit it, all right? That's an untenable suggestion. So there was a conflict until, was it Lord Kelvin? One of the great physicists between the 1800s and 1900s said, unless there is a source of energy we have yet to discover, this is the thermodynamics of the sun. Well, in the 1880s, 1890s, Marie Curie discovers radioactive decay, the energy inside the atom. Oh my gosh, there's an energy source there. Let's keep studying that. Oh my gosh, you can take atoms and split them. Oh my gosh, you can take atoms and fuse them. And energy gets liberated. And so we started accumulating new knowledge from Earth and saying, we can make that much energy, given the composition of the star, of our sun, and generate energy for billions of years. That would be thermonuclear fusion in the core. Is it hot enough for that? Ooh, wait a minute, it's not hot enough to fuse hydrogen atoms. How are we going to do this? Oh my gosh, we discover quantum physics in the 1920s. Quantum physics enables tunneling through thermodynamic barriers. Oh my gosh. So brick by brick, or a puzzle piece by puzzle piece, we were able to completely explain every mysterious unknown thing about the sun once more and more physics became available to us. And the last bit of physics that was unknown was there was a neutrino, an exotic particle that is hardly ever can be detected, but we know it exists and we have detected it. We built neutrino detectors, and there's a certain number of neutrinos that should have been coming from the sun. We calculated that given our models for thermonuclear fusion, and we were not measuring those neutrinos on Earth. Uh-oh, maybe it's not fusion. Maybe we don't understand the fusion. Maybe our model for the sun is false. And what we later discovered was that the neutrinos were changing their identity between being emitted by the sun's core and us detecting them. It's like someone throwing you a football and you're catching a basketball, but you have a detector set up to detect footballs, okay? And you'll say, we're not getting the right number of footballs here. No, because in fact, mid-path, it changed. And this is the decay of one type of particle to another type of particle. And we measured this in the lab. And so that's recent. That's the last 20 years or so. So we're done here. We're on to other problems, like what was around before the universe? Is there a multiverse? Or what is dark matter and dark energy?
That's the enthusiasm I was talking about. You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. We're speaking with Neil deGrasse Tyson. One of the other things in the book that I wanted to touch on before I talk about, communicating again, because it is something I'm really interested in, is something I didn't know, that in the book, it says that there was a time when we had 11 planets. And I'm wondering how we got from there to eight. Now, I know how we got from 9 to 8. Pluto being killed was well covered. But talk to me about this time, the elements in the theory of astronomy by John Hymers. This textbook had 11 planets.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it listing?
Yeah, so just let me be clear. The nomenclature is something that almost necessarily has to be sort of a living organism itself, because you learn more about objects, how you might want to classify them. And there are two types of sort of classification motives. One of them is you see different things and you want to find out what's the same about them and thereby classify them together. There's another where you see two things that are the same, but you look more carefully and you find out that they have differences and now you want to classify them differently. So in fact, the English language distinguishes those two cases in a fascinating way. So you would compare oranges to apples. And if you do that, you say, well, they're both fruit and they're both round and they both grow on trees. So now you see two things that are different, but you're then exploring what's the same when I say compare one to the other. But if I use the word with, I say compare a red delicious apple with a Macintosh apple. Now these are both apples, but now I want to see what's different between them. Okay, so it's a fascinating nuance in our language. Well, the same is happening in science. So what was a planet? Where do we get the word from? It was from ancient Greek, the ancient Greeks. Planetes. Planetes means wanderers. They looked up in the sky and they counted seven wanderers. And these are objects that move, if you wait long enough, you'll see them move against the background stars. Okay? Do you know that the moon drifts westward its own diameter every hour? And you think it's just there with the sky, rising and setting with the stars. It has its own orbit around the Earth, thank you. All right? And you can watch that if you pay close attention. The ancients had nothing better to do at night. But look, there was no Netflix. There was no, So with few distractions, you kept very good track of things. So let's count the seven objects that move against the background stars. That would be Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, the Sun, and the Moon. These are the original seven wanderers, what we could say is the classical planets. And the 7 days of the week are traceable to the names of those seven planets across three cultures. The Latin, Roman, also Norse, but they're corresponding gods. So Thursday, right, is a Thor wielded lightning bolts. He's a powerful god. Thor corresponds with Jupiter in Roman mythology. And if you look in the Latin languages, so Spanish, French, Thursday captures Jupiter in their reference. So, and of course, Sunday is the sun. Moon day is Monday. Okay, this sort of thing. Saturday is Saturn. All right, so seven planets. We're good. All good. So now Copernicus comes along 1,500 years later and says, maybe Earth is not in the center of all motion. Maybe we should not be thinking scientifically about what's going on the assumption that Earth is in the middle. That can distort your view. Maybe the sun is in the middle. Oh my gosh, it is in the middle, as would be later confirmed by Galileo. Well, if the sun is in the middle, then Earth is not the center. We are one of the other objects. So we gain Earth as a planet. Okay? So now we go from seven planets to eight. But wait a minute, the moon goes around Earth. So we lose the moon. So that takes it back down to seven. And how about the sun? Clearly the sun is not a planet because it's not going around anybody. So we go from seven planets, we gain the Earth, and we lose the sun and the moon. So now we're back down to six. Okay? So we have Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Six planets. Now, go fast forward another couple of hundred years, and what happens? We discover more planets. Oh my gosh, in 1800, 1801, there's planets orbiting between Mars and Jupiter. And there was a big gap there, by the way. People said, there's got to be something there. That's a way bigger gap than it looks like this should be. And so we found four new planets there. Okay? Pallas, Juno, Vesta, and Ceres, all named for Roman gods, just the way the rest of the planets are named for Roman gods. Okay. And, well, wait a minute, this kept going. It was very excited. New planets discovered. Then we start adding back. Got up to 10, and then a fifth one was discovered. That's 11. And then people said, wait a minute. All of these new planets are orbiting in the same swath around the sun. And you know, they're kind of small. They're so tiny, they look like a point of light, like what stars look like. Stars are so far away, they're just points of light. They're not disks like the planets are through a telescope. These are just like points of light. They're star-like. So Herschel said if they're star-like, they're asteroids. Aster, star-oid-like, star-like. They have nothing to do with stars, but through a telescope, it's just a point of light. So this new swath of objects where they were getting discovered at rapid pace, overnight, basically, dropped out of the planet count. And in so doing, having dropped out of the planet count, we lost a set of planets that for a brief period of time, everyone was excited and believed were real. And they're just rocks orbiting the sun. All right, I left out, sorry. We had discovered Uranus. So that made how many planets? Seven. And then we discovered four more, and that took us up to 11. And that's where that 11 number comes from. When we discovered a bunch more asteroids, they all dropped out of contention. And now there's hundreds of thousands, probably millions of asteroids to be discovered, most orbiting in that swath of real estate between Mars and Jupiter. So that you asked a brilliant question, and I'm sorry it took me so long to answer it, but that's the full reckoning of it. And for me, in modern times, you know, we demoted Pluto as a dwarf planet. For me, planet is no longer a useful word, especially given all it's been through. We should have different words. Do you realize Jupiter is more bigger compared to Earth than Earth is compared to Pluto? So if we on Earth say, let's demote Pluto, Jupiterians, if they had a similar streak within them, they would want to demote Earth and say there are only four planets in this solar system, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. We're the big boys, all right? And the rest of you all are just debris. We would have no case if they made such a declaration. So I just think we need a set of words to properly reckon the nuances that distinguish all the things that orbit the sun.
I suppose, as with many things over the history of humanity, it's down to perspective. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the way you speak, because not a lot of scientists speak the way you do. And I thought it was fascinating to hear that you had met Carl Sagan, you know, one of the great American science communicators, and that he had sort of singled you out, invited you to meet him and spend a lot of time with you. And I was wondering, was Carl Sagan and his TV show Cosmos a huge influence on how you speak? Or what is it about your education, your upbringing, or your childhood that gave you this gift for describing the universe? Because, you know, I know a lot of people out there wish that astrophysicists had more of this, but scientists in general, this gift to be able to communicate.
So a couple of points. First, I don't know if I was singled out by Carl Sagan. For all I know, he had, you know, he did that every week, for all I know. I do know that I had applied to college. He was a professor at Cornell, and my application, I had been admitted to Cornell by the admissions office, but I was still undecided at the time. And so the admissions office sent my application to Carl Sagan, unknown to me at the time, but they were asking him, is there anything you can do to help bring him here? And that's when he invited me to Cornell, sight unseen. I don't, you know, and he didn't know me from anything. Of course, I knew him from his books and this sort of thing. So I was very honored by such an invitation. What I learned from him is, since I'm nobody to him, yet he devoted this time out of his schedule, which was surely a busy, he's surely a busy man, that I said to myself, if I am ever as remotely famous as Carl Sagan, I will make sure to devote time to students the way he has devoted to me. I committed myself to that. And I maintain that, you know, I'm not perfect at it, but I think I'm pretty good at it. All right. I'd be on the phone, Barack, you know, there's a student at the door. I got to call you back. Okay. Call you back later. And, you know, so the rank and power of whoever I'm otherwise in a conversation with comes second to my handling of students. So I was well mature and into astrophysics long before Cosmos hit the airwaves. So I would say it had no influence on me in terms of my interest in the universe or even in my modes of communication. What it did affirm for me was that there was a hunger for the things I loved. How could this be a major series unless people liked it? And there was a way to make them, not make them, the way to excite them about it. And so that's a first point. Second, what I have found separately from that, and Carl was also good at this, but the tools today are so much more refined to connect with pop culture in a way that when I am communicating, I have a utility belt, like a Batman utility belt, that is loaded with pop culture referencing. So that when I'm speaking to you, I can pull out of that utility belt all manner of methods and tools so that while I'm communicating to you, it is not just science in the abstract. It is science connected in ways that you already care about because that's the definition of pop culture. And also I've learned that humor matters. People, when they smile, they come back for more of whatever it was that made them smile. And this is the recipe for my podcast, Star Talk. My co-host is a comedian. There's pop. It's a collision, or rather, a merging of science, pop culture, and humor. So for me, Carl Sagan was, as we say in mathematics, the existence proof that you can actually do such a thing. Otherwise, no. I'm my own. I do my own thing. And people had asked me when I ended up hosting Cosmos. Twice since him, people said, what's it like filling his shoes? And I said to myself, I can't fill his shoes. If I tried, I might succeed, but I'll probably fail because they're his shoes. But what I do know is that I can fill my own shoes. I could do that perfectly. And if that fails, then that's on me. It's not on me for failing to try to be somebody else. So I don't know if I answered your question. I'll also say that I think people wrongly overuse and wrongly use the word gift. You said, how did you obtain your gift? A gift implies you're sitting there and someone hands it to you. It does not recognize the actual work that would go into what it is someone does. So one example I'll give. I don't know what makes it across the pond over into Ireland, but on Comedy Central, the cable network, we have a show called The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And I was on his show, and afterwards people said, oh, you and him have such good chemistry. Oh my gosh, you're a natural in that environment. I guess I'm going to take that as a high compliment. Because those people have no idea what I did before I went on my first program with him. I studied how long he speaks before he interrupts with a comedic quip. And I said, all right, if I have an idea I want to put, I got to parcel it in 7-second groupings so that I can get the whole idea out. He can then interrupt with a comedy and then both live going forward. And there isn't dangling information that I have to recover and try to patch back together. And I look at what his rhythms were and what interests him. And I study that. Then I went on the show and people said, oh, you're such a natural. Oh, it's a gift.
That's really interesting. Yeah. That's really interesting. Because I knew you prepare because I work with scientists and I know the ones who succeed prepare. I didn't realize you went to that level.
Oh, yeah. It's preparing. The two levels of preparation. One is, do I know my stuff for this interview? Okay, and that's what most people think of when they say prepare. The other half of it, it's half, is do you know the interviewer? Do you know the interviewer's audience? Do you have words that will work in that setting for that audience? And not all shows have the same vocabulary that matters. And this is the pop culture dimension of it. I've been a guest on 3 food shows, okay? Three, where they make food, but they just brought in an astronaut. I think it was an eclipse or something, and it was a pop culture kind of sciency thing. But it's food shows. I have food vocabulary, okay, that I used in those settings. And people say, "Oh, you're such a natural." No, I really thought about it.
One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about before we finish up is this experts and treating experts with skepticism, because it's something that obviously in recent years, this quote of yours saying, I never want you to quote me citing my authority as a scientist for your knowing something. If that's what you have to resort to, I have failed as an educator. And I thought that was really interesting because at the moment there are people claiming to be experts and getting trust. There are people who are experts and not getting trust, but we have to put faith in someone, because I can't learn the astrophysics that you've learned in my lifetime to know, as you empirically know, what you know. I have to trust experts. So surely it's more down to choosing the right experts and then trying to understand, but we couldn't possibly take on the expertise of everyone. So there needs to be faith in experts, right?
So that's a very important point that you're raising. And so I think the landscape is more nuanced than my quote would indicate. I still feel very strongly about that quote. And the reason why that quote works is when I'm teaching people, I teach them how things work, not things to memorize. And so I can claim with some confidence that if I have succeeded, you will never have to reference me again. That's fine. But in times of the pandemic, for example, where none of us are, hardly any of us are infectious disease experts. And so it's, you can't use your own reasoning to reason how you might behave if you're not otherwise an expert. So that's a problem. So what does one do? Well, I think what's missing, at least in the educational system of the United States, we're taught science as information and facts rather than as a means of querying nature and as a means of inquiry. And so that's a problem, because if someone gives you a fact and someone else gives you a different fact, you think you can just pick and choose, right? But that's not true. And what's not, I think we wouldn't be in this problem if science were instead taught as there's research. And at any given moment, there's the latest research result. But it's not completely the truth until other research verifies it. Because you can have results that dangle in all manner of places, okay? And the press, what the press tends to do is they run to that one research result. And the more exotic the research result is, the more attention it's going to get. Oh, and it'll say things like, if this person is right, then all of our accepted wisdom is wrong. Okay, so what are the chances that thing is right? Really low. Really, really low. All right, and we have to wait for other projects to see if they verify it or not. Yeah. Chances are, you will have a wave of research that will not verify that one exotic result. But that's what people latch onto. It's like the one guy had the one paper who declared that vaccines cause autism. And then no other paper verified this. Yet people went to that. It's science, and he's a scientist, and it's not how science works. And so if more people knew how science works, I don't think we'd be in this dilemma. So then what happens is you say, so it's not just any one expert that you happen to like. Look at the range of what's out there, okay? Look at what is behind it. The numbers matter. The statistics of how many scientific branches, how many scientific people follow something and have results that agree with it, that matters. But we don't know that it matters. We think we can just pick some any result because it is science published in a journal. And most science published at any moment in a journal will be shown to be wrong or will need to be modified. And that's the entire point of the journal, to be contested on the frontier. But as things move through and as results get verified, it then goes into the canon of what is objectively true in the world. And so what do you do? I kind of like the Center for Disease Control. I like the number of scientists that participate in that. And the National Science Foundation, the National Institutes of Health, these are American institutions, of course. There's surely some counterparts in Ireland. We have the National Academy of Sciences. These are not singular research points. They're collections of understandings of what is true. Also, consider when before we knew enough about coronavirus, it's a brand new virus. It's brand new. We are discovering things daily. So if there is a research result that said, we don't think you need masks, but we're still checking on this, you go with what's latest. And then we say, no, we found other results, and these have been confirmed. Masks are, in fact, the most important thing. You don't say scientists don't know anything. You say, I'm glad for the scientific method, that it can evolve for something as new and novel as the coronavirus. People should have been celebrating the fact that every week we had slightly more information about what's going on, how to keep people alive in hospitals. Okay, we need to do this instead of that because these results came out better than these. Where was the celebration of these discoveries? It was nowhere. Because people thought that science is a result, and if it's wrong and someone else says it's wrong, the whole enterprise gets to be thrown out, flush it down the toilet. So I'm sorry, I'm preaching to you here, but I'm trying to say that without knowing how science works, people are not in a position to actually recognize what the emergent truths are and what is just hogwash out there.
Well, I don't know where you get your energy from, but it's always brilliant hearing your enthusiasm for whatever the subject happens to be at the time. Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you so much for joining
us.
Very
happy to be back on your show.
Future Proof Gold
with Jonathan McRae,
proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.